Okay, good morning, everybody. It is time? Yes, it is time. So this is Bio 241, and it is September 25th, and it's a Thursday. On Tuesday, you took your first exam. So that is over. That's, 25% of the class is done. And a lot of people stop by my office to look at their exams, and certainly I recommend that you do that. Just so that it's clear what questions you missed and maybe why. Maybe you read through a question too fast. I think most of these students are surprised that they miss a question because they misread the question or skimmed over it too fast and didn't really appreciate what the question was asking for. So if you stop by my office, you can see. And every once in a while, you might catch a mistake that I make or that the Scantron reader makes, and then you would get credit for that. And there was one question that I took off of the test, and that was the very last one. So everybody got a point for that one, right? So so it's important that you guys stop by, take a look at your tests, and you could ask me other questions, too, at the same time. All right, anybody have a question on that test? Where my office is, all that kind of stuff, office hours, it's in the syllabus, that's pretty easy to see. All right, so today we're going to talk about enzymes and energy. And probably you don't know what an enzyme is. I'm not sure you even know what energy is, so we're going to talk about those things, a couple of really important concepts. So maybe I'll just ask, does anybody know what an enzyme is? What is an enzyme? What is an enzyme? It's a catalyst. I like that. What is a catalyst? It speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction, and a catalyst also does not get used up when it's catalyzing a reaction. The same thing for an enzyme. It never gets used up. It just makes a reaction faster. All right, so that's an enzyme. What about energy? Energy is a real thing, but you can't see it. You can't weigh it. What is energy? Anybody remember what energy is? You know, when I was in this class, all right, I had no idea what energy is. And I heard a really good definition of energy, which is actually pretty amazing. You've taken some other classes somewhere, maybe a really good high school class or college level class, right? So energy really is the ability to do work. So when you have a lot of energy, what can you do? A lot of work. And you have no energy, guess what you can't do? You can't work, all right? So that's a really nice operational definition, okay, for both enzyme and energy. All right, so I'm going to put the schedule away. When is the next exam? Let's see, so 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks away. And it's going to be on chapters 4, 5, 7, and 9, I hope number 9. Right, 9 is autonomic nervous system. Hopefully we can get through all of that stuff. So these are really interesting chapters. So I'm glad you're hanging in there. Okay, I'll put that away, go over to here. On the board, I wrote some things down that I'm going to talk about, and when I turn the lights off, I'm not sure that you can see these things. So I'll try to remember to turn the lights back on. But the first thing, number one, a chemical reaction. I wanted to know what a chemical reaction is before I talk about it. These things over here, we call reactants. So A and B are reactants. And they come together, and then they turn into products, right? Maybe you've covered some of this stuff in lab, I'm not sure. If it's an enzyme catalyzed reaction, instead of saying reactants, sometimes we say substrates. Yeah, I didn't write that down completely. I'm glad I turned around and took a look at that. All right, so in an enzyme catalyzed reaction, so maybe I'll put, what, an E and Z right here. For an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, the reactants are what we call substrates, and then through the process of this reaction, they become products. All right, so that's a chemical reaction. Second thing that I want to remember is when I look at the pH curves for enzyme activity, I need to make a comment about that. So if I forget, make sure you raise your hand, let me know. I talked to a couple people, so if you're one of the people that talked to me about that curve, make sure you raise your hand. And then I have this right here. All right, I got two cases of an enzyme-catalyzed reaction. One is called allosteric, and the other is called orthostatic. And I'll describe this one. You have a really good slide, but it's not labeled just like this. Right? So I do want you to label allosteric and orthosteric. And the only difference is this little circle thing here. This little circle in orthostatic is in the active site, but for allosteric, this little cofactor is not in the active site. It's in some other site on the enzyme that is not inside the active site. Two different ways. I'll clarify it probably a little bit better when we get to that particular slide. And then, look at this. Anybody live in a house like that? No? That'd be a really cool house, but I don't live in a house like that. We're going to talk about that, too, in just a little bit. All right, so let's get started with lecture. The first part is going to be on enzymes. All right, so we're going to talk about enzymes, metabolic pathways, and then finally some bioenergetics. And that's basically, how does your body do work? And how does your body get energy to do work? That's really important. Okay, so enzymes are what we call biological catalysts. So a catalyst is just something that speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction, right? If there is a catalyst, then a lot of C and D will be produced in a hurry. If there's no catalyst, then A and B might stick around for 1,000 years and eventually get converted into C and D, but it's going to take a really long time for that to happen. All right, like all the wood that we have in this room. Right, it wants to burn, right? It wants to turn into carbon dioxide and water, and since there's no enzymes around, it just sits there, and it will sit there for many, many years. We can put a catalyst on wood, namely a bar of zinc, and zinc will actually burn wood. It can burn a hole right through a piece of wood, but at low temperature, because that zinc will act as a catalyst to turn that piece of wood into carbon dioxide and water. Most of these enzymes are catalysts, but they're biological, which means they're a biological molecule. You know a bunch of biological molecules, like what, proteins, lipids, nucleic acids, carbohydrates, right? Almost all of them are proteins. Some are nucleic acids. There's just a couple that are nucleic acids. There might be some others that I'm not aware of that are lipids or sugars, but probably not. Okay, and how do they work? How do they speed up the rate of a chemical reaction? They do that by lowering the activation energy required for that energy for that reaction to proceed. All right, so now I got to describe some of these things. You're probably maybe familiar with these first two things, but not this third one. All right, activation energy. All right, so let's take a look at these four graphs. Really important four graphs. And to understand a graph, what do we have to look at first? Yeah, look at the axes first, right? All right, so let's look at the two top graphs, and they look pretty similar, right? You see that the shape of this graph is pretty much the same. As a matter of fact, the shape is exactly the same. Only the tail end of that curve has a different shaded area. All right, so you can see that this is the number of reactant molecules, okay, just the number of these A's and B's, and since we're going to look at an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, maybe we should actually call that on the slide substrate molecules. You could call them that, right? And if we measure the energy of all the reactant or substrate molecules in a solution, they all don't come up with the exact same energy. There's a little bit of a distribution, right? Just like we're not all the same in here, reactant molecules are not all the same either. They have different energies. Right, so there's going to be a few that have very little energy, and on the other end, there's going to be a few that have really high energy. And then if we look kind of in the middle, this is where most of the molecules are, have like a mid-range of energy. And if we were to measure all the molecules and measure their energy and plot it out on this curve, like energy of reactants versus how many there are in this particular container, room, or whatever, we would see this distribution. And it kind of looks like a bell. So sometimes people call that a bell-shaped curve. Right. So this tells us something about the energy of reactants. And the first column represents when the reaction is not catalyzed by an enzyme. The second column is when it is catalyzed by an enzyme. So let's go back to this first column here. We see that when a reaction is not catalyzed by an enzyme, right, there are very, very few that can participate in this chemical reaction because it requires a lot of activation energy in this particular case. So the area here is very small. When we put an enzyme in this reaction, we don't change the shape of this energy distribution. It's exactly the same. But when we put an enzyme, we said that it lowers the activation energy, right? So instead of being way up over here, we lower the energy required for that reaction to take place, and then we measure the number of molecules, and can you see that this is a much greater area on the right compared to the left? All right, so that's really the big difference, and that's why we say that an enzyme reaction lowers the activation energy. It goes from here, right, over to here, or from here way down to here. You don't need as much energy to catalyze that reaction. So what is a good way to think of this? Let's look at the bottom two graphs. Here we have a plot of energy versus, well, just the reaction that's taking place. So this means high energy up in this area, means low energy down over here. Here we have some reactants or substrates, and here we have some products. The products are at lower energy, and we know that reactions like to proceed from high energy to low energy, and in that process it's going to release energy to some other molecules or into the environment, maybe heat, for instance. All right, but so here is this ball, and it wants to roll downhill, right? But look what's in the way. We have this wall that's in the way. And this wall is a certain height that represents a chain, energy, right? And so we can measure that energy with this blue line right here. Right? So in order to get this reaction going, we have to put this amount of energy in before it can start to run down the hill and proceed. Maybe think of a wood example, right? If you don't want to wait around for millions of years for wood to turn into carbon dioxide and water, and you don't have a piece of zinc, how can you get that wood turned into carbon dioxide and water today? What could you do? You could add energy to it by what? How would you add energy to wood to get it to turn into carbon dioxide and water? You would just take a match, right? And that match is giving off energy, put it underneath that piece of wood. The wood would heat up. That increases the energy of that wood. And then what happens to it? It's going to release a lot of energy. The wood is going to burn. And all the wood then will end up as carbon dioxide and water. So the wood turning into carbon dioxide and water is one way that you can think of burning that piece of wood, just burning it up. Okay, so here we have a piece of wood. We need to add energy to it for it to burn up, to get down to this product level. All right, so that's a lot of energy. But if we're really smart, we can come up with an enzyme that will work on that piece of wood. And what does it do? What can you tell me about the height of this wall over here on the second column? Is it as high as the first one? No, it is lower. All right? So in order to get that wood to start burning up, turning into products, right, you need what? More energy or less energy with the enzyme? Less energy. That's why we say an enzyme, right, speeds up the rate of a reaction because it decreases this activation energy. I'm going to give you another example in just a little bit, but here is a nice graph of that. All right, so we got two cases, without an enzyme on the left, with an enzyme on the right. And what can you tell me about the activation energy, left compared to right? Where is more energy needed in terms of activation energy, the left or the right? It's on the left. Can you see that this arrow here is bigger than this arrow here? I think you should be able to see that. And that is what? Just the amount of energy that we can read from this vertical axis. Here's another important point. When this reaction proceeds, notice that the reactants have one energy level and the products have another. Which has a lower energy level, reactants or products? Products have a lower energy level, right? Because you can read it on this graph over here. It's not a number, but at least you get a sense of what direction is happening. All right, so the amount of energy that's released is the energy that the reactants have at the beginning minus the energy that the products have. That's the difference, right? And so this kind of looks like a green arrow to me. This is the amount of energy that's released, right? It's just the difference between reactants and products. Now let's compare the two columns. What can you tell me about the release of energy from a non-catalyzed reaction to a catalyzed reaction? Can you see that? It looks pretty much the same, right? Yeah, I don't think you can tell that one is more than the other. And if you were to take a ruler to it, it would be exactly the same, right, with a very critical eye, you would see that the energy released when a reaction is catalyzed by an enzyme or not catalyzed by an enzyme, the energy released is exactly the same. All right, so what's the big deal? What's the big deal with an enzyme? What does it do? It just speeds up the rate of the reaction, but it can't release more energy. It just speeds up the rate. And how does it speed up the rate? By reducing that activation energy. That's what an enzyme is. Remember, an enzyme is just a biological catalyst. And that wood analogy that I was talking about with zinc, right? With zinc, you can burn wood, but you don't need to light a match. You can still do it at a low temperature, which means what? The activation energy decreases, right? When you burn wood, for instance, with that catalyst, a piece of zinc. All right, so this is a really important figure. I'm sure it's an exam figure, so look it over. See me during office hours. Ask your lab instructor to go over it. All right, so the important thing about an enzyme is that it speeds up the rate of a reaction by lowering this activation energy. And the energy that's released is exactly the same from one condition with or without that enzyme. That's going to be a nice question in back of the book or one of the online questions. Okay, mechanisms of enzyme action. Well, we said that it lowers the activation energy or lowers the energy required to get the reaction to move. Remember enzymes, we said, most of them, over 90%, maybe over 99%, are proteins, which means that they have a three-dimensional shape, right? They have a tertiary structure, and we call that a conformation. And there are spots within the surface or on the surface of these proteins that are active sites because substrates can fit into those active sites. And when substrates fit into those active sites, then they fit together. They're brought together, and substrates have to be brought together before a chemical reaction can take place. All right, so enzymes act by bringing substrates close together so that they can react. That's an important point. So here's that chemical reaction. Here I see an enzyme as a protein. Here is a certain spot on the surface of that protein, and we're going to call this the active site so that these substrates can bind to this area right here. Now, how do these substrates, what allows these substrates to bind to the active site? It is by shape. Yeah, it's by the shape. If the substrates put together have the right shape that fit in there, then they go ahead and just fit right into that active site. And when they are, they're close together, and what can happen? The chemical reaction can take place to form a product. All right, so here we got what? Substrates. And here we have a product. So here is the active site. And it just means that the protein has to have this particular shape in order for it to work. And if you change the shape of that enzyme, what happens to the function of that enzyme? It changes, right? It might be toned down a little bit or it might be stopped altogether. So what is a good way that I like to think of how an enzyme works? Okay, so I got two substrates right here. I got a blue and a red. Is that red? Brown? Okay. We've got a blue and a red. Okay? And the product is going to be a, how do you guys read? You guys read from left to right? Okay, so the product is going to be blue-red, like that. That's the product. Here are the two substrates. And they could be like that, right? And if they come together like that, all right, if they come together like so, is that blue-red? No, this is red-blue. That's not the proper substrate. How else can they come together if they're floating in solution? They could come together like this to form a plus sign. They could go together like this to form kind of like an X. Okay? How else can they come together? Well, there's a million different ways, right, that they can come together. And when they come together in one of these other ways, guess what never forms? The product never forms. The blue-red never forms. The products have to come together just in this orientation in order to get the product that you want. And the enzyme makes sure that that happens, that these two substrates come together just in the right way so that they can react. And that reduces the activation energy barrier for this particular reaction. Okay? And of course, these markers only fit in the active site if they have the proper shape for that to happen. All right, so another important concept of an enzyme, not only does it speed up the rate of a chemical reaction, but it also makes sure that the product is the one that your body needs. It doesn't come up with all these side reactions. So enzymes are real important, speeds up the rate of a reaction, and it only gives you the product that your body requires, not other kinds of products like pluses and X's and boxes and all things like that. Okay? So think about that for a second. Ask me sometime. That doesn't make sense, but that's just another way of thinking about how an enzyme works. Because of what? It brings substrates together just in the right way so that the reaction can take place. Here's another exam figure. Right? Mechanism of action. So I see an enzyme here. Kind of looks like a gray molecule. And here's a substrate A, substrate B. And can you see that substrate A can fit into this little crevice inside the enzyme? Right there, and substrate B can fit into this one. All right, so since it can fit on the surface of this protein, we call this the active site. And what can you tell me about the shape of the active site? It's got to be right? It's got to be complementary to the shape of the substrates, and if you change the shape of this active site, then these substrates can't bind. Okay, so before the reaction can proceed, the substrates have to bind. And it has to form this complex. This is what we call the enzyme substrate complex. And then since the substrates are brought together just in the right way, the reaction proceeds, and then we end up with products. The products then are released from the active site, and then you have this little beast left over. All right, so we got A plus B with an enzyme going to C plus D. We got two on this side. So A plus B, you could call them reactants, but you could also call them substrates, because it's an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, right? So the substrate is a reactant. Now, what can you tell me about this enzyme over here and over here? Does it have the same color? Same color, right? It has this thing here and this thing here. Is this thing here the same as there and there? Yes. What about the top of the molecule? Is this the same as this over here? Yes. So what can you tell me about an enzyme before and after it catalyzes the reaction? No change, right? That's the definition of a catalyst, even a biological catalyst. The enzyme does not get used up in a reaction. What does get used up? The substrates get used up, or the reactants get used up, because they are used to make products, right? And this enzyme can do the job over and over and over and over again, okay, until it maybe gets some instructions to stop, or maybe it wears out or something like that. But remember, enzyme-catalyzed reaction, enzyme is unaltered. So, what has to form before products form? There is a complicated molecule that has to form before products are developed. And that is this middle one right here, which is the enzyme-substrate complex. If the enzyme-substrate complex can't form, neither can products. Right, that's necessary. So if something gets in the way right here, maybe some other molecule takes up this spot in the active site, then we don't get the enzyme-substrate complex, then that reaction will be inhibited. Okay, so that's important. Enzyme-substrate complex has to form first. All right, here's something pretty easy. I think we talked about this already. In modern nomenclature, we can understand when something is an enzyme because the suffix at the end of the word is going to be an ASE. And a lot of times we'll name an enzyme by the substrate that it works with, right, and then put an ASE on the end of it. So for instance, what kind of enzyme will break down a lipid? You could say a lipidase, but more commonly we call it a lipase. Right? Lipase. What kind of enzyme breaks down a protein? You could say proteinase, but usually we're not so complicated. We just say a protease. Right? Or something that breaks down a carbohydrate, right? Is a carbohydrate. If you ever see that ASE at the end of the word, that means that it's an enzyme that can either put things together or take things apart. Okay. Here are two important ones that I want you to know right now, because we'll be talking about these for the rest of the semester. Right? We have a phosphatase. A phosphatase is an enzyme, right? Because I see that ASE right here. ACEs, that just means it's plural, but it's an enzyme that removes a phosphate group from a molecule. So if we go back to this slide and then we draw that functional group on there, a phosphate group, remember that PO4 group right here? This is a phosphorylated enzyme, and if there is another enzyme or something that takes that phosphate off, that would be a phosphatase that takes that phosphate off. So phosphatase takes the phosphate off. A kinase, on the other hand, this enzyme was named before the modern nomenclature took effect, so it doesn't really tell you what the substrate is, but a kinase is an enzyme that adds a phosphate to something. So if we go back to this enzyme right here, and there's an enzyme that puts a phosphate group on this enzyme, that would be a kinase. Now what can you tell me? Think a part of your nervous system. What does this phosphatase and kinase remind you of? What are they doing? What does a phosphate do? Phosphatase removes. What does a kinase do? Adds. What's the effect of these two? In the first lab, you went over this a lot. They are antagonistic to each other, right? Phosphatases and kinases are antagonistic to each other, right? And is that really a bad thing in terms of a control system to have antagonism? No, provides for precise control and balance, right? So here's a little molecular mechanism that reminds me of what parts of your nervous system, the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, right? Or in terms of musculoskeletal, it would be biceps and triceps. Antagonistic mechanisms are very important. Okay. Sometimes the name may specify the substrate, like phosphatase over here. And sometimes by the activity, the enzyme that they're actually catalyzing, like dehydrogenase, lactate dehydrogenase, is an enzyme that works on a molecule called lactate, and it takes a hydrogen off of it. So the definition is even in the name of that enzyme. That's really nice. For instance, if you're trying to remember a muscle, if the muscle name has the origin and insertion in it, then that makes knowing something about that muscle really easy if you know that nomenclature. Here are some examples. These are all important biological catalysts or enzymes. These are all proteins. Catalase will break down a damaging compound in our body that's produced sometimes. This is hydrogen peroxide. You might have this at home in a bottle, really dark bottle. Catalase then will turn hydrogen peroxide into water and oxygen. And of course, you got to work out the stoichiometry here to know. Because you probably know that that hydrogen peroxide that you have in a bottle, right, will stay hydrogen peroxide for a pretty long period of time. But as soon as you put it on a cut on your body, what does that hydrogen peroxide turn into? It starts to bubble, and those bubbles are oxygen, but it also irrigates the wound. It flushes bacteria out. It also produces water. Right, and because you have a compound that's very similar to catalase in your body that breaks this compound down. So which is faster? How is this hydrogen peroxide broken down faster? When it's sitting in the bottle without the enzyme or when it's put on a cut that has the enzyme? Yeah, the cut that has the enzyme speeds up the rate of the reaction. And how does it do that? By, you don't have a picture of this in your mind, just an analogy, it does that by reducing the activation energy barrier for that reaction. It just makes it happen faster by reducing the activation energy. And as a matter of fact, if you have that hydrogen peroxide bottle around in your house for maybe 50 years, when you open it up, guess what you're going to find in there? You're going to find oxygen and water. You're not going to find very much hydrogen peroxide because that's its natural tendency. An enzyme cannot make a chemical reaction go against its natural tendency. It can only speed it up, right? And what's another way of increasing the energy of that hydrogen peroxide in that bottle maybe that you have at home? Anybody have a hydrogen peroxide bottle at home? What does it look like? Brown. It's not clear glass, right? It's a dark plastic. Why is it a dark plastic? To keep light out, because light is energy. If light gets in there, then that might be enough energy to overcome that activation energy barrier, and that will speed up the breakdown of hydrogen peroxide. So instead of waiting 50 years for it to turn into water and oxygen, it might only take a year to do that if you increase the energy. So it's protected from sunlight. Okay? That's why it's in a dark bottle. Here is another important enzyme. We'll be talking about this one even at the end of the semester, carbonic anhydrase. It can take a carbon dioxide molecule, right? Now, I think you're familiar with carbon dioxide. Have you heard of carbon dioxide before? Yeah, because we exhale it from our body, right? That's an important reason why we exhale. If we have carbon dioxide in water, right, is water in your body at all? Is that an important molecule in your body? Answer is yes. So both of these are really important molecules in your body. They can be converted into carbonic acid, and so that's a hugely important kind of reaction, and it needs to happen very fast because then carbonic acid can be broken down into bicarbonate, and then we're going to learn something about bicarbonate a little bit later on in the class. So carbonic anhydrase, do you remember the name of that one? That will be really good. Amylose is a sugar. Amylase is what? It's a hydrolase that breaks down amylose. Right, so it can break down starch into maltose. Lactate dehydrogenase, we talked about. Ribonuclease, is that an enzyme? Yeah, because there's an ASC on the end. What does it break down? A ribonucleotide. Not a deoxyribonucleotide, but a ribonucleotide, which is an RNA. So you do produce a lot of ribonucleases in your body, okay, and deoxyribonucleases because you don't want this genetic material floating around your cell unless it belongs to you. So your body produces these enzymes to break these nucleic acids down if they don't belong to you. Right, so it breaks down RNA into its building blocks, which is what? Ribonucleotides, which you learned something about previously. All right, so enzyme activity is just defined as the rate substrates are converted into products. How fast that happens, the rate. It's the amount per time. And let's take a look at a couple of these graphs right here. Enzyme activity as a function of temperature and pH. Temperature on the left, pH on the right. And so we're looking at enzyme activity versus temperature on that first graph. And we see as we move from left to right, what happens to temperature on this graph? It's increasing, right? We put it underneath a Bunsen burner, put it on a stove, we increase the temperature. It goes this way. Here's enzyme activity. And what can you tell me in this beginning part of the graph, if we increase the temperature of an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, what about the rate? How would you want to talk about that? Yeah, you said speeds up. Another really good way of talking about it is what? Is it directly related or inversely related? Directly related. That means as temperature goes up, so does enzyme activity. Right. And then when we get to around body temperature, kind of plateaus, right, and then if we increase the temperature even more, say up to 100 degrees, and that's when water starts to boil, what happens to enzyme activity then? It drops all the way down, right? It starts to drop. Okay, so this says that enzyme activity is directly related to temperature because temperature means how fast molecules are moving around in solution. So the faster things move around, the faster they can get into the active site, faster they can get out, the products can get out. So the reaction speed increases. Another way of saying rate, I suppose, is speed. And if we increase temperature and keep increasing it, it levels off. And we see that there is an optimal temperature for this particular enzyme reaction, and you can see it's right around body temperature. So here is the optimal. This is what the fastest speed of this particular enzyme or enzyme activity. And then if we go above that, right, then it starts to drop very, very rapidly. And why does it start to drop? Why does it start to drop? So remember, temperature has to do with molecular motion. The higher the temperature, the faster things start to wiggle around, vibrate around, spin around. Okay? And an enzyme is what kind of biological molecule? Protein, lipid, carbohydrate. It's a protein, right? Big, complicated molecule, has a particular shape. When the temperature is increased and it starts to bounce around and vibrate and bend and twist, and when the temperature increases so much, it can bend and twist in a certain way that it changes the shape of the active site. And if the shape of the active site changes, then it's not going to match up with substrate, so enzyme-substrate complex won't form, which means the products won't form either as a result of that. So temperature can distort the shape of a protein. Right, and if we increase the temperature a certain amount, like up to boiling temperature, right, then the activity of that enzyme can even go to zero. So the active site is completely destroyed. And can you tell the difference between a normal protein, let's say maybe at body temperature or a refrigerator temperature, compared to a protein that has been cooked? Can you tell a difference? Okay, say Say I have a hamburger, this raw hamburger, in my refrigerator right now, right? And I'm not French, so when I go home and have that hamburger, I'm not going to eat it raw. What am I going to do? I'm going to put it on the barbecue. I'm going to increase the temperature of that hamburger, and it's going to cook. And does a cooked hamburger look different than raw hamburger? Yeah, absolutely. So all those proteins in the hamburger have been denatured. The shape of those proteins have changed. The consistency has changed. Right? And so now it's a lot more edible. Okay, so that is what we call denaturation due to heat. When you cook something, it denatures that food. All right, so now I've got a nicely cooked hamburger. I've been waiting all day to eat it, right? And it's cooked, ready to go. And then I get a call on my cell phone, and some of my friends down at the pool hall say, hey, we got three people. We need a fourth person to shoot pool. Please come down right away and join us. So I got a decision to make. What am I going to do? Stay at home, eat a hamburger, or go shoot pool? Well, for sure, I'm going to go shoot pool, right? I'm not just going to stay at home. So I go shoot pool. What do I do with my cooked hamburger? I don't want it to go to waste. What do I do with it? I put it in the refrigerator. What happens to the temperature? It drops back down. Okay, then when I come back home after shooting pool and look at the hamburger, does it look like raw hamburger once again? No, it's been denatured. So another concept with denaturation is that it's irreversible. When you denature a protein, it's irreversible, it's catastrophic, cannot go back to its what we call native configuration or conformation. Different ways that we can denature a protein, right? One is temperature, another is by radically changing the pH or radically changing the salt concentration, and you know that we cook foods by doing that too sometimes without temperature. What kind of food you cook with changing the pH? Maybe putting an acid on it. Like ceviche, fish, yeah? That's a really nice way of denaturing fish. Very, very nice. You could bring that into class anytime you wanted to, as long as you share it. So what the acid does, it changes the conformation of those proteins. And it is what? Denaturation is irreversible at low temperature. You can do the same thing with salt. You can preserve foods with salt as well. All right, so that is denaturation. Let's look at the curve on the right. We got a plot of enzyme activity versus pH, and we got three different enzymes. I've got pepsin, I got salivary amylase, and trypsin. And you know, what is the pH in most parts of your body? What's a nice normal range? 7.35, 7.45, but basically around 7, pH 7, which is neutral. All right, there's a part of your body that's very acidic. You ever learn where that is? What's very acidic? Yeah, stomach, very acidic. pH 2, maybe even down to 1 at sometimes. There's another part of your body that's very basic, very alkaline, and that is your small intestine, right next door to your stomach. All right, so there are enzymes that work in those different places, and guess what their optimal, right? What is their fastest rate of conversion into substrates? Okay, where is their optimal region? Pepsin, right, has an optimal at pH 2. Right? And as we increase the pH to normal and even a little bit more basic, notice that the activity decreases because the shape of the active site is changing. Where would you expect to find an enzyme like pepsin that has an optimal working activity at pH 2? In your stomach. Yeah, and indeed, that's true. Right? Salivary amylase. Right? That's, of course, you know, that to be a pepsin was named before that nomenclature took effect, right? So otherwise it would be an ASC of some kind. Same thing for trypsin right here. Salivary amylase breaks down sugars, right? And that's, can you see the optimum right here is about 7, pH 7. And the pH inside your mouth is not acidic, it's not basic, it is mostly neutral. So that's where the optimal activity for salivary amylase is. And trypsin, let's look at trypsin. What is the, where's this maximum at? Where's the optimal pH for trypsin? All right, so here is 8. Like right in the middle is going to be 9. And if we go up, where's that? Oh, it's just right on the edge. So the optimal on this particular illustration is, what, if we go from here down to here, it looks like it's what, about maybe 9.5 or something? Okay. And so that's the kind of pH that we have in the small intestine. So pepsin works in the stomach, trypsin works in the small intestine. You need both of those environments, both of these enzymes to break down proteins because they're hard to break down. Peptide bonds are very hard to break down. Okay, so there is an answer sheet that I put in for some quantitative questions in your textbook. And the answer that I give for the optimum pH for trypsin is 9.5, which you see on this graph. However, if you look at the graph in your book or in that question set, they actually shift the trypsin curve over to the left a little bit so that when you look at it carefully, it lines up exactly at 9. So that's why I have on the answer sheet 9, because I didn't see that they changed that curve around. Kind of see what I mean? Okay, so the answer sheet corresponds really to this graph here, not the one that's in the question set at the end of the chapter. I didn't realize that until just today. So depending on what version of your book you have, right, 9, 9.5, those would all be good answers for trypsin. Okay? Okay. So here are a list of different enzymes. I don't want to go through these, but you see that they have different optimal pHs, like pepsin 2 obviously works in the stomach, pH 9, alkaline phosphatase, well, that works on bone, but it has to be this pH in order for to remove phosphate groups from hydroxyapatite. So not necessarily small intestine, right? But we see small intestine for trypsin. And there are some enzymes at the end of nerve endings that need a very alkaline pH as well for their optimal activity. Let's talk about two items right here, cofactors and coenzymes. All right, but first you got to tell me what an enzyme is. What is an enzyme? It's a catalyst, and in particular, somebody said a biological catalyst. And mostly biological catalysts or enzymes are made out of proteins, right? Okay, so think of a protein, and remember that's a big, complicated molecule. It's got to have the right kind of shape. It's got a lot of amino acids. And when you think of coenzyme, I want you to think of a big organic molecule, just like an enzyme is a big organic molecule. A coenzyme is a large organic molecule. Most of them are vitamins, right? As opposed to a cofactor is not organic and it's not large. It's actually really dinky. And it's just a metal ion like copper or zinc or calcium, magnesium or manganese. These are really good examples of cofactors, right? And what can you tell me about these cofactors? Are they large molecules or small? They're small. Yeah, so cofactors are small. Coenzymes are big. Right? So that's the best way to think of it. Not every class uses that definition, but in this class, that's what we're going to use, right? And I wish everybody used that definition. Your book does, and I like that a lot. Okay, so these are examples of cofactors. And we're going to talk about some examples of coenzymes in a little bit. What a cofactor does is that it can change the activity of an enzyme. So that's what I have on the board right here. All right, so I have an enzyme. I've got two substrates. Right, it comes together to form an, what's this thing right here? Enzyme substrate complex. When that forms, what can form? Products. And then what are you left with? An enzyme left over again. Okay. There is a third little piece, a third little entity right here. I left it off. Let me put it in. Here is a cofactor. A cofactor can bind to the enzyme. And it can bind, is this cofactor here binding to the active site? Where does it bind? To some other site on the enzyme. Not inside the active site, but to some other site on the enzyme. And what it does, it changes the conformation of the enzyme a little bit. And it makes the active site more proper to bind these substrates. All right, so what would this cofactor do in terms of the rate of the reaction? Would it speed it up or slow it down when it's bound? If when you bind the cofactor, the active site gets more perfect for accepting these two substrates, it speeds up. Right? So cofactors can be used to moderate enzymatic reactions. And the example I just said, by speeding it up. All right, and then after the reaction takes place, what happens to the cofactor? It comes back exactly the same way, just like an enzyme does. A cofactor doesn't get used up. All right, so that's what we call allosteric control or regulation. when a cofactor binds to a site other than the active site, outside the active site. But when it does, it still changes the conformation of the enzyme. Here is another example. That cofactor could bind to someplace within the active site, makes it more proper for the substrate to bind, like I have right here, but we still have an enzyme-substrate complex, so that produces a product, and then you're given the enzyme and the cofactor back again. Right? So again, this cofactor sped up the rate of the reaction because it made the active site more proper in shape, but it's in the active site, so we call that orthosteric. Right? Allo versus ortho. Allo means other than the active site. Ortho means within the active site. Two important ways of controlling enzymes. And this cofactor sometimes speeds up the rate of a reaction, but sometimes it slows it down. If your body wants to turn a reaction off, right, and this cofactor builds up, then the reaction can be turned off without denaturing this enzyme. So that's a way of controlling reaction rate, is with these cofactors. A coenzyme, on the other hand, what's a coenzyme? Is that big or small? Coenzyme. What about an enzyme? Is an enzyme big or tiny? Yeah, enzyme is big. So coenzyme, just think big organic molecule. Its job is not to moderate a chemical reaction like what we're looking at here, but it brings things to a particular chemical reaction. So we say it transports, right? So it transports maybe substrates to a reaction. Maybe a cofactor will bring this thing along so that it can bind. Maybe this is lost someplace in the cell. Right, so a cofactor brings this thing to the enzyme so that the reaction can proceed. Sometimes, and maybe you even want to think of coenzymes as even just bringing energy. Maybe not a molecule, another part of a molecule, but it brings energy to a reaction to get it to proceed. Right, but remember, coenzyme is big, organic. It brings something to a set of chemical reactions. So here is that nice slide that shows that cofactor binding at the bottom of the enzyme. So what would this be called? What kind of control or regulation would this be controlled? Allosteric. That's allosteric, right? Outside the active site. So modify your slide, write that in. And then what about this one, where the cofactor binds right within the active site? That is orthosteric, right? I don't think your book ever mentions orthosteric, but I can't remember allosteric unless I know something about orthosteric. Hopefully that helps you out. Okay, enzyme activation. Many enzymes are produced in an inactive form, and that's really wonderful because there's an organ in your body that produces digestive enzymes like trypsin and chymotrypsin, which breaks down proteins. And does anybody know what organ that is that produces those enzymes? And lipases as well? Your pancreas, right. Right, so your pancreas produces these enzymes. Now, what if your pancreas produced those enzymes in an active form? What would happen to the pancreas? It would get digested away, right? And, of course, that's terrible. Those enzymes should be produced in an inactive form in the pancreas, then transported to the small intestine where they are activated, and it's fine if they do their job in the small intestine, right? That's where they should be working. Okay. So not all enzymes are produced in an active form. They are activated when they get to their proper site of action. And that's probably one of the reasons why pancreatitis, pancreatic cancer, is just a really terrible, hard-to-treat disease because the pancreas loses control of producing those enzymes and making sure that they're turned off when they're in the pancreas. So when somebody has pancreatitis, what does the pancreas do? It starts to digest itself. That's really tough when that happens. Okay, so how can we activate? Many are phosphorylated, okay, and some are dephosphorylated. What kind of enzyme is necessary to phosphorylate an enzyme, to activate it? That would be a kinase. What kind of enzyme is used to inactivate an enzyme by dephosphorylating it? That would be a phosphatase. And remember, they're antagonistic to each other, which now you know is a beautiful thing. Right, others are activated by small molecules. We can call these ligands. Sometimes they're cofactors, but sometimes they're other kinds of things. And we looked at these other things before. They're called second messengers. And these enzymes are inside the cell. Where do you always have a second messenger? Inside the cell. And a second messenger appears inside the cell because what happens? Because there's a first messenger sent. Where's the first messenger always located? outside the cell. Yeah, so there's a signaling molecule outside the cell that can affect enzyme activity inside the cell through this second messenger system. I'm not giving you an example right now, but soon we'll be looking at some of those examples, specific pathways. Okay, so here we have another graph. What do we want to look at first? Axes on the graph, right? So we're going to look at reaction rate or the speed of a reaction versus the concentration of substrates that we have right here, right? So if we look at this, how would you describe substrate concentration and reaction rate? How are they related to each other? Directly related. We increase one, we increase the other. Increase substrate concentration, increase the rate of the reaction. Right, so here you have that active site. The more substrates we put in there, the more likelihood they're going to jump into that active site. So concentration does matter. But you also notice that after a certain point, if we increase substrate concentration, it levels off. The rate of that reaction no longer increases, even though we dump more substrate into that beaker. Why is that? It gets saturated because you still have the same number of enzymes, and they are already occupied by substrate, right? So if we put more substrate in solution, we don't make more enzyme-substrate complex. It's already 100% formed. It can only go as fast as, what, 100%. And so you have this plateau. All right, so enzymes are characterized by those same characteristics that we looked for membrane transporters, which was what? It was saturation, specificity, and competition. So a substrate is, the enzyme is specific because the substrates have to have the right shape. And if there's a molecule that has almost the right shape, so it kind of fits into the active site, what does that do? It blocks the real substrates. That's what we mean by competition, right? And that's all determined by the shape of these different kinds of molecules. Reversible reactions. Here's another little topic. Some enzymatic reactions are reversible. What about this arrow right here? Is this one way or two way? One way. This is not a reversible reaction the way that I drew it because I only see an arrow on one end. Right? If I put an arrow on both ends, then this reaction could go to the right or could go to the left. Some reactions can go to the right or the left when the energy of the products is very similar to the energy of the substrates, then the reaction can kind of wiggle back and forth. Right? Okay. So both the forward and backward reaction is catalyzed by the same enzyme, and the direction of the reaction is governed by the law of mass action. And we also call that Le Chatelier's principle. Maybe you've heard of Le Chatelier if you've taken some chemistry maybe. So what does that say? Here I see a reaction, water and carbon dioxide going to carbonic acid. Tell me the name of the enzyme that catalyzes that reaction, speeds it up. That's on a previous slide. It's also on this slide, right? It's carbonic anhydrase, right? Your body has plenty of CO2, plenty of water, plenty of carbonic anhydrase. This reaction can, look at this arrow right here. How can it go? Can it go from left to right? Yeah, can it go from right to left? Yeah, but you want to know which way it's going. And this is how you can determine that. It's the law of mass action or Le Chatelier's principle. Right. If we increase the concentration of carbonic acid, then it's going to force the reaction to the left. So if we increase something on the right side, it's going to force things to go to the left. Or if we take away carbonic acid, it's going to force the reaction to the right. Right. So it's going to just work the other way. If what happens to this reaction? If we increase water, what's going to happen? It's going to move to the right. If we increase carbon dioxide, which way is that going to force the reaction? Again, to the right. If we take carbon dioxide away, which way is the reaction going to go? It's going to go back to the left to replenish that amount of CO2. And if we take water and carbon dioxide away, what's going to happen? Then it's really going to go to the left, right, to rebuild these compounds. So that's the law of mass action. As long as the energy of water and CO2 together equals the energy of carbonic acid, then this reaction can just go back and forth, and it does it really fast. How come this reaction can go backwards and forwards really fast? Really, really fast. Why is that? Because you have a catalyst, right? You have an enzyme, which you call carbonic anhydrase. Okay. If that enzyme wasn't there, and you put in a lot of carbonic acid, it would still force the reaction to the left, but it might take years or decades. With an enzyme, it will happen very quickly. Right? And we don't have like decades to wait around for these chemical reactions to take place. All right, so look at that. There's a good end of chapter question on law of mass action. So make sure you can figure out which way that reaction is going to go. A metabolic pathway is just a multi-enzymatically controlled steps of enzymes that are, or reactions that are linked together. So it's a sequence of enzymatic reactions that begin with some substrate or substrates. Here I have A as a substrate, and it's converted into B, and it's very fast because I see an enzyme that converts that. B has a little bit different shape than A. So when B is converted into another compound called C, then enzyme number 2 is going to be a little bit different than enzyme 1 because the shape of B is a little bit different. Right? And then this enzyme converts B into C, and another enzyme can convert C into another compound D, and then again and again and again numerous times, but we only have three steps in this particular example. And then a final step converts it into the product that your body actually needs, and we're just going to call that F. For final product. So this is what we call a metabolic pathway. A metabolic pathway has a number of compounds like B, C, D, and E that we call intermediates in this reaction. So A gets converted to F via what? The production of these intermediates that are controlled by enzymatic reactions. That's a biochemical pathway or metabolic pathway. All right, so for instance, you produce CO2 in your body, that's the final product, but it just doesn't automatically appear. It appears as a result of a metabolic pathway, a multi-step pathway. And you're going to be really interested to see how that happens. End product inhibition. Here we have, what do we have right here? A going to B, going to C, going to D, going to E, going to F. What do we call that? Metabolic pathway. Okay, that's a metabolic pathway. And we see that this is a little bit different than on the previous slide because at C, what happens at C? Yeah, there's a branch point which means that metabolite or intermediate C has two possible fates. It can be converted into D or it can be converted into D prime. And depending on what product your body needs, right, if we can continue on with the metabolic pathway, right, if your body needs F prime, then this bottom pathway is operational. If your body needs product F, then the lower pathway is inhibited so that the top pathway predominates. So how is it that we can turn off, right, this activity of enzyme 3 prime here making D prime from C? Well, when your body has enough F prime, right, there's the concentration of F prime increases inside the cell, inside the solution, and it wanders around in the cytosol, and it can even bump into enzyme 3 prime. And when it bumps into it, okay, almost like a cofactor right here, when it bumps into it, it binds, it changes the active site. And when it does, right, then the active site no longer has the proper shape. So what happens to this lower metabolic pathway if we change the active site on enzyme 3 prime? That it stops catalyzing the reaction. So what happens to C? It goes then all the way to F. And so that's what we call endpoint inhibition, when the endpoint or the final product of a metabolic pathway increases, right, to the point that you have enough, then that pathway is shut down. That kind of almost reminds you of one of the first topics that we talked about in this class is homeostasis, right? So when you have more product than you need, that metabolic pathway is decreased. When you don't have enough of that product, then the metabolic activity of that pathway increases to bring the product back up, right? So it goes high and then low, high and low, and then fluctuates around what? Some set point of F, of that intermediate F, or the product F. And where does this inhibition usually take place in the body? This is a pretty important term. Right, it happens at a branch point. Right, it happens at a branch. So here's a branch point. It doesn't happen here. Right, it just doesn't turn this enzyme off because then, right, then it doesn't turn this enzyme off because D prime has no place to go. But if it's at a branch point, then C can go to another important chemical reaction in your body. So it's usually at a branch point. And here I see inhibition, and in the slide it says usually occurs by allosteric inhibition. So where is this final product binding to enzyme 3 prime? Active site or site other than the active site? Outside the active site, right? Allosteric means outside the active site. So that's why I put that diagram on the board. Okay, bioenergetics. Do we have a little bit of time? Oh, good, we have a little bit of time. Okay, so I covered that. That pH curve is different depending on what book you have. Sometimes trypsin, it shows it at 9, sometimes at 9.5 pH. Probably not too important, but take a look at it. Chemical reactions, right? And then we looked at allosteric versus orthostatic regulation. And it could be inhibition or it could speed up. All right, so we talked about energy. What was energy once again? Those of you who never studied it, but hopefully maybe it's kind of something's reminding you of what energy is. When you have a lot of energy, you can do a lot of work, right? Okay, so we're going to talk about that energy that allows work to take place. And we've got just two laws, only two. That's not too many. The first law says that energy can be transformed from one form to another, but can never be created or destroyed. So there are different forms of energy. So who knows of like one kind of energy? What's one kind of energy? Maybe I heard potential. Potential energy is a form. Okay. What's another form? Because we want to convert. What about light? Is light energy? Yeah. Right? Light is a form of energy because that's why hydrogen peroxide is in that dark bottle, because light is energy. It changes the dynamics of that hydrogen peroxide. Okay. What kind of energy is in your body to keep it alive? What's the most? ATP. Yeah, nice. So ATP is energy in the form of a chemical, right? So energy is in the form of a chemical there. What's another form? Somebody said kinetic. I like kinetic. Okay. What do you use kinetic energy for? Like moving your car around. But what does your car need in order to get kinetic energy? It needs gas. What form of energy is gas? It's chemical. So what the engine does in your car, it converts chemical energy into mechanical or kinetic energy. And then what can you do? You can do work with your car. It can take you from one place to another. It can take you up a hill, for instance. Okay, but without that chemical energy, okay, no work can be done by the car. So what's another conversion of energy? Oh, what do plants do? I'm really jealous of plants. What can plants do? It can take light energy and convert it into chemical energy. A plant can make sugar molecules just by being out in sunlight. And why am I jealous of that? Because if I was a plant, I could sit on the beach all day long and like drink a milkshake. That'd be wonderful, right? Or eat candy bars. That's what a plant does. We can't do that, unfortunately. All right, so energy can be converted from one form to another, but in the universe, the total amount of energy just stays the same. It can only be converted. All right, here's a kind of a weird concept. Number two law of thermodynamics states that energy transformations, like when energy goes from one form to another, increases entropy, right? And entropy is just the degree of disorganization of a system, all right? So for processes to take place, entropy increases, which means what? They become more disorganized. So you're probably thinking of yourself, well, gee whiz, I'm not disorganized and I'm fine. I'm still alive. How is this? Okay. Let's look at these two piles of dominoes that I have right here. Which one, okay, has more entropy? Which one has more entropy? One with the dominoes just scattered around on the tabletop, or these dominoes that are making this really fancy building right here? Which one has more entropy? The scattered, because entropy means what? Disorganization. Do you see more disorganization here compared to here? The building is a lot more organized. And how would this reaction take place? If you were to take these dominoes, the building blocks for this building, which way would these dominoes automatically go? Would they go from disorganized, high entropy, or to an organized form, low entropy? Would this building automatically build itself? The answer is no, right? But can this building go to this higher state of entropy, meaning more disorganization? Yeah, okay, we just need a little should I give it a little activation energy? Okay, I'm going to give it you might have to pick up some dominoes. Huh? That might be too much because you might hit me. Okay. Okay, so let me get a little activation energy, and will this building gain entropy? Yeah, it's going to go to a more disorganized state, right? Okay, hold your ears. Ah. Wow, I'm really good at building this building. Nice, stable building. Okay, so what happened? What increased? Entropy increased. Things got more disorganized. That's the natural tendency of things, to go from low entropy, high organization to low organization. That's the natural tendency. So in terms of your body, what's the natural tendency? To fall apart. But you're not falling apart. How come you're not falling apart? Well, how did I make that building? Okay, here we have high entropy, and then I went to low entropy. What did I need to build this building? I needed energy. Okay, so if we put energy into this high entropy, we can go to a low entropy state, right? So the reason why you can be low entropy is because what do you require to maintain all of that structure? You need energy to keep your body healthy, right? So if we put energy into a fancy system like our body, we can fight that entropy, we can stay organized, we can stay alive, right? And here's another thing, only free energy, which is what? Energy that's in an organized state can be used to do work. So when we knock that building down, we could have used all of that potential energy that was in the building when it got converted into kinetic energy. If we were smart, we could have maybe used some of that energy to perform work. Like if we had a turbine right here, or a wheel or something that spun around, maybe it could have produced electricity or something. All right, so systems always go from a state of higher free energy to states of lower. This is the opposite of entropy. Entropy always increases when it becomes disorganized. So, I don't know, should I do that example again? Not necessarily so, but to me I see what's going on there. Okay, so here we have another graph. We have a graph of free energy versus this nice little graphic. I see a sun, and what can you tell me about the sun compared to this plant in terms of energy? Higher, right? It's way up here on the axis. Here I have a plant, and then it's relatively low energy. Here's carbon dioxide and water. What kind of energy does carbon dioxide and water have? This is free energy. What kind of energy? It's way down over here. It's chemical energy. Yeah, there's chemical energy in CN2 or water. But is it as much energy as the sun? No, it's way down here on the axis, right? So the energy, the free energy in CO2 and water is way less than the sun, right? Just because I see it on the graph right here. What about glucose, which is C6H12O2, right? That's a nice carbohydrate. And we got some oxygens left over. And as a matter of fact, CO2 and water can be put together to make glucose. Now, what has more free energy, glucose or carbon dioxide and water? Glucose has much more free energy. All right, so this process of CO2 and water going to make glucose just can't automatically happen. What is really fancy about this plant? What's required to make this house? Let's say glucose is this house. What's required to make this house out of all these dominoes? Energy. Where does the plant get energy from? It gets light energy from the sun. Right? So when it gets light energy from the sun, it can decrease entropy because there's a lot of entropy here, a lot of molecules floating around, not so much entropy here. Right? But that's okay because this machine has figured out a way, right, how to use energy to make something more complicated from something that's more random. So that's the beauty of this machine. All right. So there's that energy now that was in the sun, got into glucose, and what do? We don't have chlorophyll, we can't use light energy like this plant can, but fortunately there are plants, we can eat plants. And when we eat a plant, we get this energy right here in the form of glucose, and then what does our body do? It converts it back to CO2 and water, in which case then we get this amount of energy to then run our bodies, right? To do work. To do what? Like to build that building right there from a bunch of dominoes. So this is a pretty interesting slide because of that. Let's look at maybe a little bit more important chemical reaction that happens in us. So here again is a plot of free energy versus the reaction that's taking place. And we have sugar and oxygen, and we can see that, and then we have CO2 and water over here. Which has more free energy, CO2 and water or glucose and oxygen? More energy is glucose and oxygen. Okay, and that's a complicated molecule, so there is less entropy in these molecules compared to these. Right? There's a lot of entropy, but it also means there's less free energy. So as glucose, what can you do with glucose? Well, you can burn it up, okay, to release all of that energy. And have you ever burned glucose? Ever? Probably. Like you make a food, kind of caramelize it, that's a way of burning it, or what else? Creme brulee is when you take a torch and burn sugar on top of that dessert, right? Okay, so you can burn sugar to get the temperature high enough, and just like when you burn wood, that's going to release more energy. When that chemical reaction releases energy, guess what we call that? That's what we call a exergonic reaction. All right, so our body does the same thing. It takes glucose, converts it into CO2 and water, but it doesn't do it by combustion. It does it in a number of steps with these enzymes. So it converts glucose into, what do we call this thing here? It's another molecule, and then another one, and then another one. What do we call these different molecules here? These are intermediates in a biochemical pathway, just like one of the previous slides. And each one of these steps, right, so here's intermediate number one and number two, and when it goes from intermediate one to two, what's released? Energy, and you can see intermediate number two is at a lower energy compared to one. All right, so here we have a low entropy system going to high entropy. This automatically happens. And when it happens, what does our body get out of it? It gets that energy, right? And because plants put all of that energy, that light energy, into glucose, which is chemical energy. So again, the total amount of energy is the same. It just is transformed from one form to another. All right, so what did a plant do? It took CO2 and water, made glucose out of it. It got this amount of energy from the sun. So what do we call that reaction? The reaction where the products have more free energy compared to the reactants. It consumes energy, right? We had to put energy in. How do we characterize a reaction that requires energy? Then that's an endergonic reaction. Yeah, endergonic. If it's a reaction that releases, then that's exergonic. Okay? And it all depends on the free energies of the reactants and the products. Okay, so you're probably wondering, how can something go from a low entropy state to a high entropy state? Okay, and that's because the way that energy is transferred. So here we have two circles, right? Reactants to products, and here is the graph of free energy, and these two circles represent two different kinds of reactions, exergonic and endergonic. Again, what does an exergonic reaction do? Release or consume energy? It releases energy, right? Like going from low entropy to high entropy, that releases energy. That automatically happens. And then here we have a reaction where the products have more energy. That's like building a building. How can you build a building? Well, you're going to require energy. You've got to put energy into these reactants, ends up in the products, and what our body does is that it couples two different kinds of biochemical pathways. One is exergonic, and the one that, for instance, makes ATP, which is a chemical form of energy, right, is endergonic. How does your body make ATP, this endergonic reaction? It has to couple it with an exergonic reaction, and the exergonic reaction has to release more energy that ends up in ATP. There's always some wasted energy right here. Right, we're talking about efficiency. Does anybody know what the efficiency of a gas engine is, automobile engine? The energy that you put in compared to the amount of energy that does work? Oh, yeah, it's bad. It's probably less than 10%. Most of the energy just goes into heat, into our atmosphere. Very wasteful, but we still have a lot of gas, so it doesn't matter too much. Right. So the exergonic reaction has to release a lot of energy in order to go from a high entropy system to a low entropy system. Right. So this small wheel is not automatic, but the big one on the left is automatic, and they can be coupled together so that they both work together. And that's how most ATP is produced in your body. The production of ATP is coupled to a very large set of reactions that release energy. And what do we call reactions that release energy? Exergonic, right here. Okay, so read through this right here. It's a little confusing, but I think I could answer your questions when you come up with them. Okay? Okay, so here is ATP. We talked a lot about ATP so far. ATP has three phosphate molecules, or inorganic phosphate functional groups, right? And this is an adenine base, and this looks like a nice ribose sugar, right? It's not a deoxyribose. And the chemical bond, I see a nice covalent bond between, we call this the gamma phosphate, here's the beta, here's the alpha. Alpha means it's closest to the sugar. These covalent bonds are strong. Remember, covalent bonds are strong. But especially between these phosphate groups, that's an extra strong covalent bond. So we call it a high energy bond. When we break that high energy bond, where does that energy go? It's available. It's available to do what? What can you do with energy? You can do work, right? So here's a high energy chemical bond. When it's broken, that energy is released. And that energy can be used to do work in your body, like maybe muscle contraction or running ion gradients so that you can think thoughts and things like that. All right. And why do we call this thing here ATP? Why is this fancy molecule ATP? I won't ask you to draw this out. Why do you call this ATP? Because this T stands for triphosphate. And how many phosphates do you see? 1, 2, 3. That's the triphosphate. All right. And when you break this bond, what are you left with? You're left with this inorganic phosphate that I see here, and then you're left with two phosphates, and that's called adenosine diphosphate. Okay, and in order to make this ATP, you need adenosine diphosphate, inorganic phosphate, but what else do you need? It's not on the slide, which you should write in. In order to make ATP, you need this high energy. So you need ADP, you need inorganic phosphate, plus what else? You need energy, right? And that energy then ends up in the form of this nice high energy bond in ATP. So ATP has that energy. It can be released to your cells to do work when this covalent bond is broken. So we're going to talk a lot about this particular molecule. How important is ATP? Time we got. Not very much time. Okay, so I can't finish this chapter, but I'm going to say one last thing about ATP. How important is ATP? Well, you break it down into ADP all day long so that your body can do work. How much ATP does your body need to stay alive every day? Okay, and for a typical person, you need 40 kilograms of ATP. How much is 40 kilograms? How much are you? You are 70 kilograms. So 40 kilograms is more than half your body weight, right? And so if you don't have that much ATP, what's going to happen to you? Oh, you're going to die. Okay? So that's one way of thinking about it. You don't have to carry a suitcase of ATP around with you because your body can remake it from glucose and other things. Here's another way of thinking about ATP. All right? You make ATP mostly from mitochondria that need oxygen. Right? And ATP is important to keep your brain alive. So those mitochondria in your brain need oxygen. But if we cut off the oxygen supply to your brain, like when somebody goes into heart fibrillation or your heart stops beating altogether, blood's not getting to your brain, no oxygen is getting to the brain, mitochondria stop making ATP, how long can you maintain consciousness when your brain can no longer make ATP? This is amazing when you know this. It's two to three seconds. 2 to 3 seconds, your brain loses consciousness. Right, when it can no longer make ATP. Not very long. Right, so if somebody has a heart attack, stops beating, it's almost immediately that they lose consciousness. Now the brain is still alive. There's still a little bit of ATP in there. But your brain is eventually going to die if it can't make ATP. When does your brain actually die? 1 to 2 seconds, you become unconscious, but when do you die? When does your brain die? 2 to 3 minutes, right? Then somebody is brain dead. And once you're dead, can you ever come back to life again? No, that's another catastrophic, irreversible process. That's why CPR and these is so important, because you can maybe get enough blood to the brain, enough oxygen to keep it alive. If you're doing chest compression CPR on somebody, they might not become conscious again, but you prevent their brain from dying. So just because you're doing chest compressions and they don't wake up and shake your hand and say thank you, what should you do? Keep doing chest compressions, right? And you might save their life, because somebody might come, get their heart started again, or to the hospital and get that blood supply going through their brain. But can you take your time when somebody passes out? Can you take your time doing chest compressions? No, because you only got a couple minutes, right, to help them out. So that's how important what ATP is, just in terms of consciousness and how healthy your brain is. Okay, that's it for today. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. I think I passed it around. I did? Okay.